Today on Central Standard, a look at high-achieving exam schools. One man says they should be the model for education in this country. You can find out more on Central Standard coming up after the news from NPR.
Good morning, Kansas City. Everybody these days seems to have an opinion about what to do with good students, what to do with gifted students, what to do with bad students, what to do with bad teachers, what to do with good teachers, what to do with underperforming districts. Lots of questions, not a lot of answers. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today we examine a book that addresses at least some of these questions. It's called Exam Schools, Inside America's Most Selective Public High Schools. One of those public high schools is right here in Kansas City, Lincoln Preparatory Academy. And joining us by phone from Washington, D.C. is Chester Finn, president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's also a former assistant U.S. Secretary of Education and the author of books such as Charter Schools in Action and Troublemaker. Welcome to Central Standard, Mr. Finn.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Now, as a former Assistant Secretary of Education, you're out of that sort of public sector game now. What do you see happening in our educational system in America?
There's lots happening. It's not yet paying off terribly well in terms of academic achievement results for kids, but we're trying a lot of things, ranging from technology to new approaches to teacher evaluation to more forms of school choice to higher standards and greater accountability. I'm optimistic about what we're trying, but I can't prove to you that it's paid off yet.
What was your role as an Undersecretary of Education? What were you in charge of?
Research, statistics, assessment, things like that.
What did you find on the inside? What were the patterns of the educational system here that you found either troubling or encouraging or something to build on or what?
Well, I've been in and around this field for a long time, both before and after that that go around in the government, which is now about a quarter century ago. We've got a deeply entrenched system of about 90% of the kids in public schools, about 10% of the kids in private schools. The primary responsibility is with the states, most of which have delegated it to the district. I think that a lot of aspects of it are archaic, in my opinion, and not working very well, and actually serving now as obstacles to changes that we need to make. So I am become something of a radical about education reform nowadays.
Before we move on, what aspects were archaic?
I think the basic structure is archaic. The governance system, the elected local school board, I think is dysfunctional all over the place. I think the local district funding is archaic now that we've got kids going to cyber schools and taking courses from the other side of the country. I think our system of teacher preparation and licensure is archaic because there turns out to be no relationship between certifying teachers and their effectiveness in the classroom. I could go on. I think there's a lot that's archaic.
I'm sure you could, and let's move on to your book. It's called Exam Schools. What is an exam school?
Well, Exam Schools is the title that we and the publisher gave to a book about a very interesting subset of American public education, which are the academically selective public high schools of the United States. Some of them are famous, the Bronx High School of Science, the Boston Latin School. Others are pretty obscure, but nobody had ever look to see how many of these schools there are or where they are or what makes them tick or whether they do kids any good. They're basically academically oriented public high schools, college prep, essentially aimed at for high-achieving kids, and they are whole schools. They're not a random advanced placement course within a regular school. These are complete schools. So my co-author and I, Jessica Hockett, and I went out hunting for them. We found 165 of them around the country.
In 30 states, 165 schools in 30 states. How did you go about selecting them?
30 states plus D.C., and three of them are in Missouri, by the way.
Right, right.
We set up several criteria. They had to be a whole school. They had to be academically selective. They had to be academically oriented. They had to be a fully public school. They had to have a graduation class, which is to say they had to actually have all the grades of high school represented. And a few more things. We went for academic orientation rather than, let's say, arts and music orientation. And it took some hunting. We probably got a few on the list that don't belong. We probably missed a few along the way, but since nobody had ever even tried to make this list before, we're actually fairly proud of the search effort that we undertook.
The subtitle of this exam schools book that you put together with Jessica Hockett is called Inside America's Most Selective Public High Schools. How did you even pare down to what you would select?
We used a whole lot of different search methods, and then once we had a school we thought was a candidate for this list, we did our darndest to check with the school or with the district where it's a district school to see if it really did meet our criteria. We used best high school lists from U.S. News and so on. We used SAT scores as a clue to finding high-achieving high schools. We looked at a couple of related lists of schools, that some of which belong on our list and some of which don't. And at the end of the day, we sometimes had to rely on, I guess I will call them informants within, let's say, the Philadelphia school system to tell us which ones qualified and which ones didn't.
Now that you've identified these schools, was there anything that all of these 165 schools that you selected, was there anything that these schools sort of had in common achievement-wise?
Most of them are high achieving. Not all of them. There's a subset of a dozen or 15 that actually turned out to be surprisingly low achieving, even though they are selective admission, which is an interesting circumstance. We didn't go looking for achievement. We went looking for these other qualities of the school, essentially how they take in students. And on what criteria, rather than on their overall test scores as schools. We then matched them up with another set of data from a terrific group called GreatSchools.net, which essentially has evaluated every public school in America according to how it does on its state tests, Missouri state assessments, for example. And GreatSchools rates really every public school in the country from 1 to 10 based on the school's average academic performance on the state tests. And it turns out, and we put the great schools ratings for our 165 schools right into the list so people could see for themselves, the overwhelming majority of the schools on our list get an 8 or a 9 or a 10 from great schools, which means they do well on their state assessments. There's a funny little subset, though, of selective admission high schools that are five or lower on the great schools ranking, suggesting that their academic achievement, at least in terms of their own state system, is not what we might have expected it to be.
You have three schools, as you mentioned, from Missouri on this exam schools list. One of them is right here in Kansas City, Lincoln College Preparatory Academy, with an enrollment as of 2009 and 10 when you did the study of 1,002 with grade levels 6 through 12. What did you find out about schools like this, and how did they make the list?
Well, they made the list by fulfilling the criteria that I mentioned in terms of how they take their students in, and being public, and being academically oriented, and being selective, which is to say, they have to have more applicants than they have space for, and they have to have some mechanism for selecting among those applicants on the basis of some version of academic performance. Occasionally, especially in New York City, it's just a test score that determines whether you get in or not. In most cases, however, it's more like a college admissions office that looks at at test scores, yes, but also at grades and teacher recommendations, sometimes at student essays, occasionally interviewing the kids. They're selective, let's be clear, because they have more applicants than they have room for, not because they necessarily set out to be selective. If we had more schools like this, actually they'd be less selective because they'd be able to accommodate more kids. Essentially, all the schools on our list are oversubscribed, and sometimes by factors of 10 to 1 in terms of students who would like to come whom they don't have room for. And oftentimes, many of those applicants are fully qualified to do the work at these schools, but the schools don't have the capacity to accommodate them. Lincoln Prep in Kansas City, you might have noticed on our list, it also got a 10 from the great schools ranking.
It sure did. Higher than a lot of these other schools on the list, and that's the highest ranking.
Yeah, it's as high as you get, which means that on the Missouri state testing system, about which I do not know very much, I should say, this school does at around the top in the state.
You mentioned in the book that Los Angeles, my native town, I came out of the L.A. Unified School District.
Lucky you.
Did not, exactly. Los Angeles did not have, quote-unquote, exam schools, while New York did. What is an exam school by that criteria?
Well, what happened in Los Angeles, as far as we can tell, is that the LAUSD, and indeed the city of Los Angeles, does not have any entire public schools that are academically selective.
Right.
It has some well-regarded magnet programs within some of its regular schools. But we've had a bunch of emails from people connected with North Hollywood High School.
Right.
Who have essentially said, why isn't our school on your list? And the answer is because the gifted program there, the advanced program there, is a magnet program within a general high school and therefore did not meet our criterion of being a whole school. If we had gone looking for programs within schools, to be honest, we'd still be making the list. There'd be lots and lots and lots of places, and it would be really hard to define what is a program and what is just a random AP course.
Right, right. Certainly, certainly.
So we look for whole schools, and in New York has a bunch of them, and Los Angeles does not. And the largest numbers we found are in New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia, which have sort of clear populations of this kind of school. And then there are a bunch of cities, including big cities, including Los Angeles, that don't have this kind of school. It doesn't mean that Los Angeles is doing a reprehensible job of educating its high-ability, high-achieving kids. You are, I have no doubt, a living, breathing example of Los Angeles's capacity to do this, but not in whole schools, and that's what this book is about.
Speaking of which, these schools sort of make the list as the most selective public high schools, but you also mentioned that they are oversubscribed, meaning there are a lot more applicants than there are available slots. Doesn't that present part of a problem?
Well, it presents a whole set of problems. I think the first problem is that our education system has more demand for this kind of school than it has supply, which is to say it has not supplied enough schools of this kind to meet even the existing demand for places in this kind of school, much less the additional demand that would arise if we did a better job of identifying and preparing young kids with high ability from an earlier grade level. We were only looking at high schools, which mostly start in ninth grade. Some of them start younger, but they are applied to by kids, obviously, in eighth grade. And yet any number of kids, hundreds of thousands of kids, are, I believe, being essentially lost to even eligibility for these schools, because the system doesn't find them when they're in third grade. That these are smart, high ability kids capable of high achievement. System doesn't find them young and educate them to the max, and therefore they very likely don't even end up in the applicant pool for schools like this, but they could if we did a better job with gifted and talented education starting a lot younger.
Based on what you just said about kids starting younger, do you think that, for instance, here in Kansas City, Lincoln College Preparatory Academy, which goes from 6 through 12, is a good example of catching the kids when they're younger and feeding them all the way through that sort of sixth-tiered system so you can catch them earlier?
Sixth grade's good, better than ninth in terms of
right.
identifying kids and getting them an earlier boost. I think most people in the who spend their life in the gifted education field, which is not me, by the way, would say that third grade is a better idea if you're looking for high-ability kids to move into either gifted classrooms or classrooms where the teacher is well-trained to deal with the high-ability kids in a general classroom. Because by sixth grade, you can have lost a great many kids if they are in dreadful schools and their own capacity is never recognized or dealt with.
What's special, Mr. Finn, about third grade? What makes third grade so crucial a turning point in a child's educational life?
Well, it's why a lot of states now have what they call third grade reading guarantees. The realization that if you don't come out of third grade doing pretty well, you are likely to not, that is to say on basic skills like reading and writing and arithmetic, you are likely to falter and stumble as you go through the middle grades and thereafter. And third grade, when I talk about it in relation to gifted education, is a little bit arbitrary. It could be second, it could be fourth. My real point is that the younger you start, the less human capital, human potential you're going to waste with able kids being neglected by schools that have no capacity to deal with them. And I think there's particularly a problem for poor and minority kids who may not have the money or in some cases the parent education to push their way through the system in an aggressive kind of way or to find their way into a better school neighborhood or district or suburb or private school. So I think this is a particular obligation that public education has for low-income kids and kids whose parents may not know how to navigate the system.
That's one of the points that come out in your book, Exam Schools. African Americans are overrepresented.
It was an interesting and welcome and somewhat surprising fact, because many people accuse these schools of being refuges for rich white kids at public expense. And we found that they're more like refuges for low-income and lower middle-class and middle-class families with smart kids who don't have the means to find other kinds of high-quality education for their kids. When we say overrepresented, obviously we mean a higher percentage of African-American kids in the 165 exam schools than in the general high school population of the country. We also found overrepresentation, astonishing overrepresentation of Asian-American kids. And there are a whole variety of reasons for these circumstances. For example, with regard to the black students, a number of these schools started as magnet schools for desegregation purposes.
Right, right. The legacy of Jim Crow and before Brown versus Board.
Well, some of them started as historically black high schools and turned into magnet schools after the Brown decision in order to attract white kids in order to integrate them. And some of them then sort of gradually evolved from, let's call it desegregation magnets into academic magnets, partly because that was a additional way of attempting to integrate them.
What did you find out about the role of these exam schools that you identified? We should remind our listeners, 165 schools in 30 states plus the District of Columbia. What did you find out about the role of these schools in what they call teaching to the test? Oh, that's funny.
Well, it's funny because main complaining about teaching to the test in America today is about teaching to the state assessments for purposes of accountability under No Child Left Behind. And predominantly, the kids in these exam schools can ace the state assessment tests in their sleep, and they do not need to cram to do well on the tests that everybody else gets so uptight about. Conversely, though, the advanced placement exams loom very large in these schools, and a lot of the teaching in the exam schools is helping prepare kids to do well on the AP exams. Now, keep in mind that those are voluntary exams. They are not part of a state assessment system, and nobody has to take them. Kids in these schools who are, in many cases, very competitive, very ambitious, very motivated, want to get into good colleges and things like that, believe that the more AP tests they take and do well on, the better their odds of getting into a big-name university. And so they and their parents create enormous pressure to take and do well on AP tests. And that creates enormous pressure on the schools and the teachers to prepare them for that purpose. But the most of the country's agitation about teaching to the test, as I said, has to do with the state assessments. And for the most kids we encountered and the schools we encountered, the state tests are no big deal.
And they're sort of outside of that paradigm, which is a good thing that you present in your book.
It's a good thing, but the state accountability system, triggered in part by the federal No Child Left Behind Act, is designed to help get low-achieving kids up to a level of minimum proficiency. And most of the teaching of the test that people complain about involves cramming the make it to the proficient level so that the school doesn't get dinged on the accountability system. I visited a school in Austin, Texas, where it's the only school of this kind in town, in Austin. And on the day of the state test, the kids very ostentatiously and rather arrogantly seemed to bring pillows with them to school so that after they zip through the state test, they can pretend to take a nap on their desks during the remaining testing period.
Would this be the Liberal Arts and Science Academy?
It would. It's the only school of this kind in Austin. And it's, incidentally, the most diverse and best integrated high school in Austin. But it's full of smart kids for whom the Texas achievement tests pose no challenge.
And I guess you could say the same is true for Kansas City's Lincoln College Preparatory Academy and Maryville's Missouri Academy of Science, Mathematics, and Computing, and St. Louis's Metro High School, which all sort of land on these tests. They fall outside of that box.
I believe that's right. I didn't visit any of them myself, and we don't have grade schools data for the Missouri Academy of Science and Math in Maryville, which appears to be a two-year high school with 200 kids in it. But yes, the two schools, on the one in Kansas City and the one in St. Louis, I think do follow the pattern I was describing, where the state tests are not something that they have to teach to, but they probably put a lot of emphasis on advanced placement.
Speaking of which, doesn't this exam schools paradigm and putting together these data sets sort of set up a new level of stratification among public schools? And was that intentional?
We've just described a stratum that exists. I don't have a problem with this kind of stratification if the alternatives available for these kids are dismal, low-achieving, sometimes dangerous public high schools. I think we should have more of them, not fewer of them. I don't see anything gained by forcing kids to go to bad schools. And I think a school system or a state should be commended if they can figure out how to provide good schools. And by and large, the schools on our list are examples of good schools, and more people want to come to them than they have room for. The problem is that there are a lot of bad schools as well. And some of the kids fleeing into the exam schools are escaping from the bad schools. So we should, of course, deal with the problem of bad schools. We haven't done very well at that, by the way. But in the meantime, I don't have any issue at all with having refuges that are good schools.
Our guest is Chester Finn, president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's also a former assistant U.S. Secretary of Education. His most recent book is co-authored with Jessica Hockett. It's called Exam Schools, Inside America's Most Selective Public Schools. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll talk about how to perhaps turn around some of these bad schools and how some of these exam schools, public high schools, resembled private schools. We'll be right back. And joining us once again for the second part of the hour is Chester Finn. Today we've been discussing his latest book, co-authored with Jessica A. Hockett, called Exam Schools, Inside America's Most Selective Public High Schools. Mr. Finn, you found among these schools that some of them closely resembled private schools. How so?
Well, they do. Their classwork and the quality of their teachers and the curriculum are very similar to what you might expect to find in a selective admission independent school. They are selective also, as we've been discussing. That's what defines them as exam schools in the public sector. But the kind of education they provide with the kinds of teachers they provide is of a quality that people often pay big bucks for to get from independent schools. They're also typically safe places. Their only discipline problem that we encountered is cheating, not gang rumbles or slash tires or weapons in the coming through the metal detector. They're a particularly interesting public sector equivalent to private schools for kids who can't afford private schools, I think. In a handful of cases, by the way, they're residential schools. They are statewide boarding schools paid for at public expense. So they are even more like private schools. They're more like a prep school where you would live in a dormitory.
Are these quote-unquote exam schools determining what ingredients could be necessary for developing outstanding secondary school curricula in America?
Well, it'd be great to say that these are models that every school should follow, and there are aspects of them that I think lots of schools could follow. These are schools of choice, for example. Nobody's there against their will. I think school choice and giving people options is a very good thing to do. They are single mission schools. That is, they don't try to be all things to all kids. They are true to a particular mission. In this case, it's college preparation. But you could have schools that are true to other specific missions that might be more effective if they were. One of our issues with comprehensive high schools is that they try to be all things to all people and sometimes don't do a particularly good job of any of those things and sometimes don't have a team of administrators and teachers who stay focused on let's call it a common goal, because they have so many different goals working at cross purposes. So, yeah, I think there's some lessons we could draw from these schools, including the fact that the market is signaling that it would like more of these kinds of schools for kids who want this kind of an education, and more of these schools than we are currently supplying, including 20-some states without any at all. But I don't think every school in America is going to turn into a selective admission, academically high-powered college prep school. Some more should, in my opinion. There's no doubt about it. But I think we've got a lot of different needs in K-12 education, and we should have schools that are responsive to different needs and priorities.
How competitive are some of these schools? What were the more competitive schools that you came across?
We have a chart in the book that that shows for the ones that responded to our survey what fraction of the applicants they admit, and it ranges down to about 10% of the applicants admitted, which is to say they are 10 times as many applicants as they can end up accommodating. On the other hand, we've got a couple of schools on the list that that admit everybody that meets a certain threshold. The threshold would be determined by a grade point average or a or an exam result. And if you make it across the threshold, then you are admitted to the school without any further competition. So the selectivity works in very different ways. But the largest number of them accept between 10 and 40% of their applicants, and which is to say they have between the 2.5 and 10 times as many people applying as they have room for.
What anecdotal evidence from some of the schools that you visited that just kind of blew you away?
Well, on the admissions process, I was very impressed by the pains that many of these schools take to decide which kids to admit. And I particularly admire the ones that don't just look at test scores, but actually try a more holistic review of a child's ability and motivation and hardworking qualities and so forth, much more like a college admissions office does, where the exam score might get you into a kind of semi-finalist pool based on essentially prior achievement or ability. But then they ask you to write an essay explaining why you want to come to the school. They look for your teacher recommendations. They look at how you did in middle school as evidence that you might actually do well in school, not just be smart. I thought that was pretty impressive. The New York City has an unbelievably complicated system of matching kids to high schools that's much more like what the medical world uses for matching medical residents to the residency programs around the country. And it's a kind of double-blind system in which kids rank the schools they'd like to go to in order of preference, and the schools rank the kids that they would like to admit in order of preference. And neither knows where they where the other ranks. So then the big computer does the matching system. And it works out pretty well, actually. More common in our experience would be a place like Thomas Jefferson High School in suburban Washington, which is generally regarded as the best high school in the metro Washington area. And it does this holistic college-style application process, complete with essays and grades and teacher recommendations and things like that.
What did this experience, Mr. Finn, teach you and your co-author about the way kids learn? Did you come away with this in a sense of what kids are doing differently to learn at these schools?
In general, I can't comment on the kids learning differently, but I can say that the schools organize their instructional opportunities in a much more individualized, flexible, and college-like way. And it gets even more so in the upper grades. So you'll find seniors most likely and juniors second most likely to be off campus doing a doing an independent project with a research lab down the road, that kind of thing. I think this is a we liked it, I have to say. And it seems to work well in addition to prepare kids for college, so that the anecdotes of the graduates coming back from their college saying to their teachers in these exam schools, you know, we were really well prepared for college because we were acting like we were in college when we were still in high school.
And that's a perfect segue to this next question. What did this experience teach you about how teachers teach?
Well, one of the things that we don't do well in American education is customize our teachers to the situation that they're teaching, or customize the class to the teacher. The norm in American public education is that a teacher who may or may not be deeply knowledgeable about their subject is thrown in with kids who are at widely differing levels of preparation and motivation and ability to deal with that subject. And this creates a a real problem, partly because teachers can't teach 22 different levels of achievement or motivation very well at the same time in the same class in the same 47 minutes. What we found in these schools is first of all, classrooms, basically everybody in them is eager to learn and reasonably well prepared to learn and reasonably well backgrounded in the things they would need to already know in order to succeed in this class. So the teacher doesn't have to deal with a multitude of different levels of ability or prior achievement or motivation. We also found teachers who know their subject matter and want to teach kids like this. And that's a challenge. It's a challenge in two ways. One is most of these kids are very fast moving, and the teacher's got to be pretty sharp to stay ahead of the kids and read all those papers and give feedback on all those drafts and things like that. We also found that the teachers need, in other words, the teacher needs to have a high level of motivation and a high level of preparation in order to be happy and successful in schools like this. Now, it doesn't mean these schools don't occasionally have lemons for teachers, but in general, they've done a pretty good job. The principals of the school have a lot to do with this because they've done a pretty good job of selecting or at least negotiating with the downtown office which teachers are going to teach in this school and not just have dumped on them teachers who may really not be well suited at all to these classrooms and maybe not to any classrooms at all.
What did class size or school size or number of students enrolled have to do with some of the schools that you selected? Did it make a difference at all? For instance, at Brooklyn Tech, you have nearly 5,000 students versus someplace like Rockaway, New Jersey, the Academy for Math and Science, you got 81 students. Is that a fair comparison among these schools? Was there any difference in terms of enrollment?
Well, of course, the enrollment's different. That's because you just picked them because of their difference of
right.
size. But I've been in the schools with a couple thousand kids, and they feel like big schools. They're not places where everybody knows everybody. This doesn't have so much to do with exam schools as with schools in general. You need enough kids to be able to support a comprehensive program. Oftentimes, that includes being able to offer both science, both chemistry and physics, and also biology and maybe astronomy. And you also want to be able to offer more than one foreign language. And to get to these kinds of staffing levels and curriculum levels, you have to have a certain scale. And I don't know whether a school with 68 kids can really claim that. On the other hand, there is a lot to be said for a manageable size where people really do know each other and look out for each other and where a graduating class has a couple hundred kids in it rather than close to 2,000, and where the teachers who are teaching, let's say, the 11th grade, there might be six or so teachers, eight teachers. They can get together and talk about a student, and they can deal with exceptional cases where a kid needs to be away for a robotics competition or an athletic competition, for that matter. So I think it's like the Goldilocks story, not too small and not too big, but just right.
Did you come across any instances where kids needed to be away from school for robotic athletic competitions?
Athletic robotics? No, but but the ability to be away from school and still have the school sort of be keeping an eye on you, I think, is an important thing. And some of these schools organize ambitious field trips, occasionally to other countries. The ability to learn outside of school as well as under the school roof is, I think, an important and I think reasonably widespread practice in the schools on our list.
What is the biggest threat today in our educational system? You spent some time as a former assistant secretary of education. What is the biggest threat?
Well, there are multiple threats to our education system. I think that I've got three on my mind right at the moment. One is the best known, which is the large number of kids who are barely at or below basic skills and are coming out of school and sometimes dropping out of school pretty much illiterate or close to it. And that's way too big a population of people. At the opposite end, there is this neglect of high-ability, high-achieving kids who are not being, in sufficient numbers, turned into the scientists and inventors and entrepreneurs that they could become if we were paid greater attention to kids at that end of the spectrum. And then in the middle is a problem that I guess I'm going to call smug complacency that on the part of a lot of middle class and suburban families that things are just hunky-dory the way they are for their kid in their school, and they don't look around to see that the kids in schools around the world are actually learning a whole lot more and that they should not be satisfied with what they've got.
So that's a multifaceted problem, which brings us to the next question. What do we do about bad schools, or what you call bad schools?
Secretary Arne Duncan gets a lot of credit for calling attention to what he calls the worst 5% of the schools in the country. He calls them dropout factories, and there's a lot of truth to that. It's probably more than 5% of schools that need a radical surgery, but one of the problems with the No Child Left Behind Act is that it actually targeted too many schools for repair, more than anybody's system could actually handle. And so Duncan is saying, let's focus on the worst of the worst. And I guess you got to start someplace, and I guess that's right. The problem is that nobody has got a foolproof method for turning around a dreadful school. And there's very little evidence over the years that that anybody has succeeded, at least except in random cases, at turning a bad school into a decent school. And where they have succeeded, it's usually because they've had the political ability to take really drastic action with that bad school, essentially empty it out and put in a whole new team and a whole new program and a whole new everything and start over again, which is another way of saying they've replaced the entire staff, or another way of saying it is they've closed the school and then reopened a new school in the same building as the school they closed, recycled the building but not the school. These are pretty hard to pull off politically and under union contracts and tenure laws and a whole variety of other things that get in the way of that kind of radical intervention. So we don't have a good track record on this at all. You are in Kansas City, which I'm afraid illustrates the perils and difficulty of turning bad schools into decent schools.
Yeah, we're thinking alike here because I was just about to ask you, Kansas City is a prototype for this sort of radical intervention that's well-intentioned but then kind of does worse than originally intended with the closure of schools. They closed half the schools in 2009. Are those type of radical overhauls healthy?
Well, they're not foolproof, as I think you just illustrated. On the other hand, the odds of a successful turnaround without a radical overhaul are pretty slim. And so I can't sit here and tell you with any confidence that a radical overhaul is the way to go, because it doesn't always work, and it sometimes backfires in a whole variety of ways. But I also cannot sit here and tell you with any confidence that a mild remedy is going to do any good whatsoever when it comes to altering the performance level of an entire school or the kids in it.
Of these 165 schools in 30 states plus the District of Columbia that you identified for your book, Exam Schools, the subtitle being Inside America's Most Selective Public High Schools, what did you find if at all, what did you find was the role of the school districts in holding up these particular schools as models of achievement or as bright spots?
Well, the first, let me say they're not all district schools. Some of them operate as state schools. Some of them are affiliated with universities. Not all of them are come under the district aegis at all. And some of them are loosely under the district aegis. Hunter College High School in New York City, for example, is legally a New York City public school, but it's really operated by Hunter College, which is part of the city university system.
Right.
The districts sometimes really encourage kids to come to the exam schools, and other times they seem almost to ignore the exam schools. I visited one here in D.C. Called School Without Walls, which I think is a terrific high school, but it's been widely ignored by the central administration and the political leaders of the District of Columbia. A lot of parents know about it and seek it out for their kids. But the district might as well not have it for all the attention that it has not gotten from the district. In a few other cases, districts have to buck the politics of having selective schools within them, either because of charges of elitism, which is one set of issues, or because of the principals of the other high schools grump about their smart kids being creamed off to go to the exam schools, thus diminishing various aspects of the other high schools in town. So there are a whole set of issues that arise when a district has one or more of these, and that's probably one of the reasons that there are not more of them, is because of the challenges of these kinds of pushbacks and objections.
Well, Kansas City, according to your book, has only one, and that's Lincoln College Preparatory Academy here in the, some would say, beleaguered Kansas City School District, but you know, that's open to interpretation, as is the larger educational system, depending on who you talk to. Speaking of which, you called the administrative and governmental aspect of education in America very archaic. What would be on your wish list to change the administrative ethos of public education?
I don't think there's a single alternative model that I would try to inflict upon everybody. I think that we've got some very interesting naturally occurring experiments around the country right now with structure and governance. The most visible example is probably what's called mayoral control, where the mayor takes charge of the schools rather than leaving it in the hands of the elected school board.
Antonio Vigorosa did propose that in L.A., as did Sylvester James. Our mayor here in Kansas City did that, to mixed results and reviews in both cases.
Well, I don't know about the Kansas City outcome, but in Los Angeles, he never was quite given control.
Right. He proposed it, and that's why I said to mixed results.
On the other hand, the mayors of New York, Chicago, and Boston, just to pick three examples, and D.C. also, to pick four examples, do control their schools. And no longer do they have elected school boards. This is one example of a change. There are state takeovers of schools and whole school districts. There are what three states now call recovery school districts, where a state entity takes over the management of the worst schools in the state. This was pioneered in Louisiana. There are what are often called portfolio districts, where the school system doesn't operate the schools, but rather contracts with independent operators and charter school operators to run the schools, often very different from each other. So there's some interesting models arising around the country that I think have considerable promise, and they are all very different from the sort of 1912 model of the comprehensive top-down school district run by a superintendent who is in turn hired by an elected school board. These are interesting alternatives to that model.
So you're saying we need to move from a 1912 model to a 2012 model?
That is my hope, and but I think it'll be plural models in 2012.
Your book is called Exam Schools Inside America's Most Selective Public High Schools. What's next in this study? What's next in sort of taking this exam schools evangelism across the country? What would be your intended outcome for this book as far as the larger discourse on education?
Well, I'd like to just help elevate the problem of gifted kids and the need for a more comprehensive addressing of it, and the recognition that leaving no child behind means not just paying attention to low achievers, but also paying attention to everybody, even if they are already a high achiever. They too should not be left behind by being given an inferior or inadequate education that does not help them realize their human potential. So I think that while I do believe the country would be better off with some more exam schools, I really also believe that they are just one of multiple solutions to a larger problem, which is that we've been neglecting a whole bunch of kids, and we do that at our peril as a country if we focus exclusively on low achievers. We need to focus on them, of course, but we've got to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time in this country and in our education system.
Walk and chew gum at the same time in our education system. You heard it from Chester Finn. He's president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and also a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, also a former assistant U.S. Secretary of Education. So he knows a lot about walking and chewing gum at the same time. He's the co-author of Exam Schools, Inside America's Most Selective Public Schools, written in tandem with Jessica Hockett. Mr. Finn, thank you so much for appearing on Central Standard.
Happy to be with you today. All the best.
And tune in tomorrow for Ghost Stories Missouri Style. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander with help from Tamika Weatherspoon. Up to Date is next. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.